by a UFO and taken down to Waco, Texas, where she saw a vision of Satan as the Branch Davidian compound was burning. It was, you know, real jive. Along with, you know, woman gives birth to giant ant and this sort of thing. So that I think that in dealing with this whole question, one has to be very, very careful, first of all, of disinformation, and also, frankly, you got to be careful about stepping on people's toes, something I generally do with great abandon. I'm not afraid of alienating somebody, no pun intended. But I think that when one is outside of one's own field, and when I'm talking about UFOs, when I'm talking about circular flying machines, I am out of my element. However, when you're talking about intelligence community and national security disinformation efforts, then you're talking about something I know about. The first section I'm going to read from Revelations is called Beyond the Hall of Mirrors. Now, after a painstaking examination of many of the leading ET or UFO experiences, and Vallée does a very good job, very kindly pointing out that it's BS and not attacking the people who are doing this. Well, some of them, he says, are obvious charlatans. He has a great sense of humor, by the way. He's also a brilliant, brilliant individual. By the way, perhaps I'll read about his background. Dr. Jacques Vallée, a former principal investigator on Department of Defense computer networking projects, was born in France, where he was trained in astrophysics. He moved to the United States in 1962 and received his PhD in computer science in 1967 from Northwestern University, where he was a close associate of the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek. The author of numerous articles and three books about high technology, Dr. Vallée first became interested in the subject of UFOs when he witnessed the destruction of tracking tapes of unknown objects at a major observatory. He then has gone on to research. At one point, he was director of information systems for Stanford University. So he's no intellectual lightweight. He was at an observatory in France when he and a bunch of other highly trained professionals observed unknown objects flying through the atmosphere with performance characteristics unlike any known conventional aircraft could produce at that time. And what interested Vallée in the whole issue of ETs as a political and intellectual path of inquiry was that he was the only person who wanted to report it. The other seven, they all agreed that they saw them. The other seven did not want to report it because they said, basically, that'd be the end of our careers. You know, we'll lose everything. One of the really asinine aspects of many of the attempted debunkings of UFO sightings is maintaining that, well, the experienced commercial or military pilots mistook the planet Venus on a bright light, on a bright night for a UFO. Bloody hell, man. Commercial and military pilots know what the planet Venus looks like on a bright night. Beyond that, there are other explanations, such as they wanted to achieve publicity. They were publicity hounds. No, an experienced and accomplished military or commercial pilot has nothing to gain by inventing a myth of seeing a story about seeing a flying saucer. On the contrary, they have everything to lose. Their professional standing, possibly their family. They can destroy their whole lives. So the notion that they would invent some story in order to gain publicity is baloney. They might gain publicity, but they'll lose their livelihood. Not something you want to do. But this is what interested Vallée in the whole question. He realized how powerful the whole question of flying saucers could be from a psychological standpoint. All eight highly trained and eminently professionally qualified observers saw these things, but he was the only one who wanted to look into them. The others saw them, but they said, hell, destroy the tapes. We'll lose our heads. We'll lose our professional hides. They didn't want to deal with it. That's what interested Vallée in the whole question of UFOs and ETs. And after examining and discussing a number of examples, in particular the Brent Waters case in England, where military personnel at Air Force bases, And this one incident, a quote UFO unquote, came down from outer space or whatever, the Earth's atmosphere, quote crash landed unquote near a U.S. Air Force base in England, and high-ranking officers from the base, including the base commandant, went to the site, and the three alien beings came out of a UFO, and the base commandant actually had a discussion with these ETs. Right? Well, after discussing this and how highly improbable it is that the intelligence personnel who disclosed this would have done this, and I can't obviously present the whole book due to the limitations of time, but after presenting what I consider to be a very convincing discussion that in fact it is highly unlikely that these were ETs, but rather this was some sort of psychological operation, some sort of covert operation being engaged in by the military and the intelligence community. And Vallée goes on to write, two questions must be explored in the context of the deception theory. They apply equally well to Pontoise, to UMO, U-M-M-O. That was a totalitarian alleged ET cult. Yes, I'm going to have to set a pretty brisk pace here. again, the discussions of the physics of UFOs, he debunks some of the alleged otherworldly technologies, but discusses circular flying machines. The important thing to understand here is the application of these devices to human society, because there is a massive and ongoing deception, a psyop that is underway. Valet says, first, how could a small military intelligence unit simulate such complex UFO events? And he says that most so-called contactees are simulations. These are psychological warfare devices, basically. And second, and most importantly, why would they want to do it? The first question is surprisingly easy to answer. There would not be a single trick, but a combination of technical devices used in such a sequence and in such a psychological context as to lead the observers and, if necessary, the public to the unavoidable conclusion that a UFO had indeed been present. Although such remotely piloted vehicles would have been difficult to produce in the early 50s and therefore cannot fully explain the totality of the UFO phenomenon, they were already well developed by the time of the Vietnam War and easily available during the period covered in the last three chapters. The devices in question can be equipped with mechanical, optical, and electronic devices that can be used in sequence or in combination to produce very spectacular UFO sightings. The simplest such device is a model of a disc 2 to 4 feet in diameter. We're not talking here about crude garbage can covers equipped with hobby rockets, but exquisitely controlled systems carrying microprocessors and guided by radio. Miniature television cameras enable these gadgets to survey their surroundings and to transmit pictures. They can maneuver in and out of trees. The inventor of such a device, who developed it for a U.S. intelligence agency in the 60s, has told me how he could make it fly around a meeting room and out of a window. It produced no more sound than a whir. Next on the list of mechanical devices are actual flying saucers of the type developed by Dr. Moeller near Sacramento, California. These vehicles are highly maneuverable and develop sufficient thrust to carry one pilot with his equipment. They are being manufactured to serve as reconnaissance platforms in hostile terrain. Their diameter is on the order of 8 feet. Equipped with lights, they could be indistinguishable from actual saucers. More ambitious UFO displays have been deployed, complete with light projectors, lasers, and sound effects in support of various media extravaganzas, such as the opening of the Los Angeles Olympic Games or the concerts of the Electric Light Orchestra. In such cases, the UFO can be of arbitrary size and complexity, since it does not have to carry its own means of propulsion. Instead, it is simply suspended from a flying crane, suitably screened from the observers by artificial fog. Some of my associates and I have thought of other ways to fly and control real flying saucers, which could be seen from the ground, photographed, and tracked on radar by perfectly sincere witnesses. When such mechanical devices are combined with optical and electronic displays, the results can be even more astonishing. Perfection could be reached with devices that could never be proven to be fakes by scientists on the ground. It has long been realized that all it took was a powerful slide projector to expose unsuspecting crowds to celestial wonders, provided there was a cloud or fog bank dense enough to serve as a screen in the vicinity. Fog machines are easy to obtain from any movie studio equipment supplier. This method has actually been used in psychological warfare. Now, one of the applications of this deception, and again, he's talking about staging UFO experiences as military psychological warfare devices, is to gain the element of surprise in covert operations, say a raid on a nuclear base or a missile facility or in covert operations, because as has been discovered in the experimental testing of some of these scenarios, a sentry, a highly trained military sentry guarding a highly sensitive military project, if it, say, saw, you know, the Virgin Mary or some sort of apparition, might hesitate to fire. If, on the other hand, it saw a helicopter coming over, it would immediately open fire. But if it saw a UFO, a flying saucer, quote, a being from outer space or something piloted from outer space, it might hesitate to fire. In fact, usually hesitates to fire for fear of starting an interplanetary war or whatever. And that moment of hesitation, gives the raiders a chance to get the drop. At that point, they can overcome the sentry and conduct a successful raid on a highly secure facility. It is simply a means of gaining the element of surprise in a covert military attack on a highly sensitive and heavily guarded facility, because the sentries would immediately open fire on a chopper or something like that. But if they see a flying saucer, they don't want to attack our brothers from space who are superior, so they'll hesitate, and that, in an operation of that type, gives the attacker the margin of victory. Valet goes on to say, Knowing that the technical means for simulating UFO encounters are available, the remaining question is, why would the U.S. military use these methods? Here again, we find a variety of rational and logical answers. They have in common the question of personal belief of the percipient, so I will preface the explanation by posing a simple situation before the reader. Suppose you were a guard assigned to secure part of the perimeter of a missile base. You know that an enemy might want to violate the perimeter in order to steal warheads, to procure nuclear material, to obtain secret firing codes, or simply to test the defenses. You suddenly see a helicopter flying low over the electrified fence in your direction. It has no running lights. What do? Presumably you do your duty. You raise your machine gun and you start shooting. Now, let us suppose you were a devout Catholic. Drifting over the fence is not a threatening engine of war with its rotor blades, but a beautiful image of the Blessed Virgin smiling at you and throwing rose petals to the ground. What are you going to do now? I don't know many Catholics who would swing that machine gun and pull the trigger. Let us go one step further. Presume that the object coming over the fence is neither a recognizable threat nor an obvious religious entity like Our Lady, but a flying saucer surrounded with lights. Perhaps some alien creature can be seen through the glass dome. If you fire, you might start an interplanetary war. Most guards will hesitate before that situation and request further orders. The resulting delay, seconds or minutes of elapsed time, may be all that is necessary for the invaders to secure the base. Far-fetched? Yes. But anti-terrorist exercises in which the attackers disguise their craft as a flying saucer have actually been run more than once, and such tests of base security probably explain a fair number of the UFO sightings around missile silos that are so often advanced as evidence by the amateur groups and cited by one television documentary after another as proof that extraterrestrials are surveying our strategic assets. In most cases, the base that is under simulated attack is never given the actual explanation for what happened, precisely because the test would be worthless if the target knew about it. In the next section I'm going to read, Vallée goes on to further develop not only that hypothesis, but also to examine the potential application of the ET myth as a psychological warfare stratagem for achieving social control, and the counter-terrorist application of these circular reconnaissance or weapons platforms. Again, these are circular flying machines, basically nothing otherworldly, but things that are known from contemporary technology. He's going to give a much more specific reference of the use of these things in order to gain the element of surprise in a counter-terrorist operation. You're going to hear some familiar names here in a minute. He also begins to expand the context to examine the use of these devices as means of broad-based totalitarian social control. That, I think, is the real application of the ET myth. Eventually, we're going to be asked to give up our system of government or part of it, and our brothers in space, who are far wiser than we are, will determine all of our affairs, and we can do away with the silly stuff like elections, you know, and laws and the Bill of Rights or jury trials. Now, after the OJ case, we know those don't work. Let our brothers in space decide everything. That'll work just fine. This is what Vallée thinks we're coming to, and it's as funny as it is in some ways, it's scary as hell. But Vallée goes on to say, as we reach the millennium, the belief in the imminent arrival of extraterrestrials in our midst is a fantasy that is as powerful as any drug, as revolutionary as any delusion that marked the last millennium, as poisonous as any of the great irrational upheavals of history. The expectation of a superior race that swept away the intelligence of the citizens of Nazi Germany was inspired by a similar myth. So was the fear of witches that moved the upright and moral Christians of England, Germany, or Massachusetts to the indiscriminate killing of thousands of citizens. Yet the UFO phenomenon is undeniably real. It is annoying, consistent, and tantalizing, seductive, and secret. Always just a fraction of an inch beyond our reach, and it draws much of its irrational power from the very experts who deny it. The rationalists, the smart astronomers who keep explaining away the universe on televised talk shows, the pundits of the human mind who think they are so clever that they can always analyze all the sightings in terms of sociological, mythological, anthropological, or psychological theory without bothering to interview a single witness. But if John Lear and others are telling the truth as they see it, what could have motivated the massive deception of which they, like ourselves, are the victims? My tentative answer is contained in the following scenario. Suppose that for the last 30 years or so, a massive effort has been going on within the U.S. government, within U.S. government agencies such as the CIA, the NRO, or National Reconnaissance Office, and the Air Force to study the UFO phenomenon. Not in an attempt to really solve it, since a solution is still beyond the reach of our science, but in an effort to use it to manipulate it as a cover for something else. Perhaps our military scientists have discovered a way to manufacture flying discs as a platform for reconnaissance operations, for intelligence gathering, for counterterrorism. Some of my contacts tell me that these discs do fly and vary in size from 2 feet for laser ranging devices and automated flying cameras to 30 or 40 feet for the devices used for such physiological effects as putting people to sleep or inducing paralysis or hallucinations in enemy troops. And such devices do exist, either in test sites across the U.S. or on the drawing boards of various Silicon Valley firms and Washington think tanks. These non-lethal weapons have been actually deployed in various counterterrorism operations around the world. It would be important to keep the knowledge of this technology secure, although hundreds of people are clearly in a position to observe it from time to time. Making people believe that they are observing flying saucers might be a clever ploy. Let us not forget that Bill Moore, the originator of the MJ-12 case, worked for Agent Doty of OSI, that's Air Force Intelligence, and that Agent Doty, alias Falcon, worked for an Air Force officer named Hennessy, who was head of security for the Stealth Project. Perhaps this connection is perfectly innocent or spurious, but why is there no official effort to clarify it once and for all? If the mysterious Falcon is only a helpless turkey, why not expose him before the world? In the failed Desert One operation of April 1980, organized by the Carter administration to attempt the heroic rescue of the American hostages from Tehran, some witnesses claimed to have seen a disc resembling a UFO. It was said to be a platform for non-lethal weapons intended to paralyze or otherwise disable the Iranian guards. And the code word for that part of the operation, of which Richard Secord and Oliver North had been among the planners, was none other than Snowbird, a name that my reader may recall seeing before. It is the code word that Bill Cooper claims to have seen attached to a secret project to test flying saucers captured from alleged extraterrestrial aliens. Again, we need to ask, which is the cover and which is the genuine project? Skipping down, such an explanation may account in part for the bizarre manipulations we have described, but it does not provide a complete answer. What if that deception has other goals, even more far-reaching? To the New Age idealists, the announcement that aliens are here would bring the culmination of many decades of dreams. It would violate all their group meditations on mountaintops, the loving hopes, the prayers for peace. It would give all of us something to worship at a time when the leaders of our traditional religions have made fools of themselves, at a time when the younger generation has very few heroes it can look up to. To the hardened ufologist, it would bring respectability at last, vindication after years of dedicated lonely research, a chance to confront such skeptics as Philip Klass and Carl Sagan, or perhaps in a more mundane way, a doubting brother-in-law, and to tell them, quote, "I told you so," unquote. He then goes on in this last section I'm going to read to speculate about a broad-based political application of this particular psychological scenario. Another aspect many researchers of this field, with a few courageous and notable exceptions, have studiously ignored is the link between the more eager proponents of imminent extraterrestrial contact and the American extreme right. When attention was first called to this uncanny linkage, the evidence was hotly rejected by the UFO believers. In the last 15 years, many more disquieting parallels have been revealed involving cases as varied as Billy Meyer's Pleiades hoax and the Dulce Papers, or D-U-L-C, Dulce. It could well be that the same kind of fanaticism that leads people to join neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic, or survivalist movements in the American Southwest also induces them to believe in the imminent arrival of aliens from the sky. It could be that those groups who are convinced that government secrecy is abused in order to hide political truths from the public also believe that the reality of UFOs has been kept from us. This is a belief that has some root in reality, but it could also be that some intelligence agency or some rogue group within such an agency has been bending the latest paranoia of some extremist political movements to its own ends, just as many cults from Jim Jones' People Temple to UMO may have served as useful, convenient testbeds for covert psychological experiments. Even those intrepid researchers who spent their time suing the U.S. Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act and clamoring for more immediate congressional hearings on UFOs have not dared investigate these murky and dangerous yet highly relevant connections. When reviewing the social organizations and the political systems of our alleged visitors, as it can be derived from the voluminous text that describes such otherworldly civilizations as UMO or ERA, it is difficult, not to be struck by the paramilitary structures they involve. Misery and hunger have long been eliminated on such worlds, claim the true believers, but their society more closely resembles Adolf Hitler's ideal Reich than a modern democracy. In Billy Meyer's Pleiades, minor moral transgressions are punished by permanent exile. By the way, who is putting up the money for the dissemination of Meyer's glossy photographs? It is always a matter of great wonder to me that the gentle adepts of the New Age are always the first to enroll under the banner of such movements whose vision of the future is basically a fascistic one. And this is what he hints at may lie in the background of the deliberate deception on the part of the intelligence services and military with regard to ETs. The propagation of a fascistic belief system in a non-existent higher power or higher race, inclining us to surrender political control to those who are the intermediaries or the interlocutors with this higher race. In other words, ETs as a cover for fascism. And I think taking that and perhaps combining that with some other types of technology that might be under research and development or becoming an actuality, and we're going to talk in the last part of the lecture about what Nikola Tesla was researching in the first part of the 20th century, and also some of the things that may loom in the background of Project HARP. I think some of Valet's ruminations concerning the deliberate deception with regard to UFOs and ETs, in particular the contactee experiences, merit serious consideration. I think we may very well at some point find our society being de-democratized through deception, through a psychological deception which would involve the manipulation of technologies that are being kept hidden from us. Let's take a short break, and when we come back we will ruminate some more about what is going on behind the scenes. And in particular, I think in Project HARP we may very well see the ultimate development of the totalitarian weapon system or dominant weapon system that the Nazi rocket scientists were envisioning with the regard to the orbital mirrors focusing sunlight on the Earth. Let's take a break of about 5-10 minutes or so, and we'll come back and we'll finish up tonight's discussion. I'm going to resume here. As almost always the case, I'm running a little bit longer than I'd expected, and I got a lot some ground to cover here. And again, I apologize if my reading from these texts seems a little pedantic. As you know, I do that on my show on a regular basis. But when I'm dealing with a technical subject like this, in which some of the areas of inquiry are outside of my main discipline, I think it's important to be intellectually honest, and I think it would be extremely pretentious and past the point intellectually dishonest for me to present myself as, you know, an aeronautical engineer or an expert on Tesla technology or some of the things that I'm going to be talking about. Yet, as a political and historical researcher, I think that some of the things that we are faced with are absolutely terrifying, and I think we need to begin taking a look at some of this technological development in a very critical sense, because again, as Albert Einstein said, everything has changed with regard to nuclear weapons. Everything has changed but our way of thinking. And now we're coming up with technologies which offer some truly horrifying possibilities. And as I said before, we're still the same beasts we've always been, except now we have power that had never been envisioned. And I think we need to understand what has been done in the past with new military technologies, including ones that are quite deadly, such as Port Chicago, and what might be done in the future with deadly revolutionary military technology. Now, while I'm finishing up the lecture, I'm going to do something that I've done at past lectures. Many people have inquired, Tim, if we could stop the tape, and this is not something we need to have on the cassette. I don't even know if Tim has this been started. Oh well, okay. Let's stop it for just a sec, Ruthie.
It's
not moving. Yeah, can you just stop it and then start it?
Pause.
Now, as we examine and bear in mind some of the things that we've already looked at, I think the possible behind-the-scenes manipulation of the whole flying saucer situation is very important as the educational system gets dumbed down, as people's belief in bogus religious systems is deliberately encouraged. I think we are very susceptible as a people to some sort of really horrible Machiavellian psychological slash religious stratagem, which could lead us to believe in the power and efficacy of beings from another planet or from someplace else that would guide our affairs, but in fact would be beings from this planet with very, very malevolent intent and technology that would be viewed as otherworldly because it's been kept secret and because, frankly, our educational system is such that it just is not doing a good job of keeping young Americans apprised of just what is possible now and as we get very close to the 21st century. There's a wonderful novel by Kurt Vonnegut called The Sirens of Titan, and it begins, I love the beginning of that novel, it says, "Our story begins a long, long time ago, sometime during the nightmare ages, sometime between the Second World War and the Third Great Depression." And it goes on to say, he talks about environmental despoilation, said gimcrack religion was big business. And he goes, he goes on to describe this time, sometime in the late 20th century. Of course, the World War I used to be called the Great War until a greater war came along, World War II, and then it was simply World War I and World War II. The Great Depression is what we call the Great Depression now, but if a greater depression comes along, then it'll be Great Depression of the First, Second, or Third Great Depression. That's very much what I think we may be going to, the nightmare ages, sometime between the Second World War and the Third Great Depression. Something which I think is going to bear very, very strongly on the world to come, and that is the application, in fact, it may be bearing very strongly on the world as it exists today. This also, I want to stress, is an area in which I consider myself a student. I walk timidly and breathlessly looking, so to speak, rather than wearing the air of concerted authority that I might in certain other areas of inquiry. Most accounts that I view as credible, one of the most important scientists, one of the most important individuals involved in research into the physical sciences of all time is Nikola Tesla, an individual who actually was the person who invented the patents that went to develop radio, not Marconi. And his discoveries in physics, even today, have absolutely revolutionary implications. And I think that the possible applications of Tesla technology, including some aspects of Tesla's technology which may have been kept hidden from most people, warrants serious, serious investigation. When I when I began to read up on Project HARP, and I've only read a few articles about it, instinct told me from the little bit that I'd read and understood of Nikola Tesla that the possible applications of Project HARP, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, could be absolutely enormous. The implications could be staggering when taken in connection with the technologies and the research done by Nikola Tesla. Some of the things that Nikola Tesla was working on and had developed or was seriously contemplating in the early part of the 20th century, I'm going to touch on now. Now, again, I am not a physicist, and I'm not qualified past the point to critically evaluate all of the information on Tesla. People that I know who are qualified in this regard tell me that Tesla is terribly important. Many of his discoveries were revolutionary. They were suppressed, that they have military applications, but also the Tesla technology has been liberally spiced with disinformation by the powers that be. So in examining Tesla's technology, and there's some truly staggering things that Tesla was researching, bear in mind there's also a lot of disinformation about Tesla technology and what it can do. Earlier this year, when the Japanese were being plagued by horrible terrorism, including terrorism affecting their mass transit system, and now this terrorism is being attributed to the Shoko Asahara cult, a mystic who, by the way, reveres Adolf Hitler as among his sources of religious inspiration. There was a very interesting prediction that Shoko Asahara made. He predicted an earthquake. He said he was going to cause an earthquake, and everybody in Japan took this as being a figurative expression, that he would not really cause an earthquake, but that something like another gas attack on the subways might take place. Of course, the Japanese were already badly shaken because of the Kobe earthquake, which had been devastating, which also shook people's confidence in the government's ability to deal with emergencies, because the government did not do well. The government is a socialist government, the first time since World War II, really, or first time in about 40 years that the Liberal Democratic Party had been out of power. The Liberal Democratic Party essentially was a repository for the old-line Japanese fascists and imperialists, many of them war criminals. When they were out of power, all of a sudden, bad things began happening to the Japanese people, shaking confidence in the ability of the socialist conservative coalition to adequately govern things. There was a very interesting thing that occurred right about the time that Shoko Asahara was predicting that there would be an earthquake. He predicted it for a particular weekend. That weekend came and went. Nothing happened. Everybody was poo-pooing that. And then the Wednesday after that weekend, two things happened on the same day. There was another gas attack in the Japanese subway, and the very same day, Oklahoma City was lit up. This was April 19th. People in Japan were taking the earthquake reference to be a figurative one, indicating that some sort of drastic terrorist incident might take place. They were very scared. They were very relieved when that didn't happen, only to find out that, in fact, a quote earthquake, unquote, did take place a few days later, another terrorist attack. Interestingly enough, the Tesla Museum and the Tesla Foundation in Belgrade, in what used to be Yugoslavia, reported that right about that time, a number of members of a Japanese mystical cult showed up doing research into Nikola Tesla's technology. It has not been determined whether these were actually members of Aum Shinrikyo or not, but I found that more than a little interesting and more than a little thought-provoking, considering the possibilities of utilizing earthquakes as weapons of mass destruction. Now, military thinkers, strategic thinkers, had predicted the manipulation of natural disasters, earthquakes, weather phenomena such as storms, other types of seismic events, as weapons of mass destruction in the 21st century. The basic goal of warfare is economic gain, and the problem with chemical, biological weapons and nuclear weapons is, although they're very destructive, if you're going to use your troops to occupy the enemy's turf in order to profit as a result of defeating your enemy, then your troops get whatever disease or get poisoned or get irradiated, and it nullifies much of the goal of waging war. For this reason, weapons of mass destruction, things which could approximate the destructive power of nuclear, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, but without the residual contamination, making it impossible to occupy the enemy's turf, again, for that reason, military strategic thinkers had envisioned using storms or manipulating earthquakes, volcanoes, things of that type as weapons of mass destruction, basically a radiationless nuke, so to speak. One of the interesting things about Nikola Tesla's technologies is that he had envisioned a number of things and had actually produced a number of things as well. I'm going to read a few sections from a book called Prodigal Genius, The Life of Nikola Tesla, Inventor Extraordinary. It's by John J. O'Neill, soft cover edition. By the way, this is often regarded as the best single biography of Nikola Tesla. It's copyrighted 1978 by Angriff Press, A-N-G-R-I-F-F. Right here, or not right here, but in Hollywood, California. The first Tesla experiment, and this is quite well documented, was Tesla's use of mechanical oscillation to produce seismic disturbances. Now, again, I want to stress that with regard to Tesla technology, I am anything but an expert. And that's why I'm going to read from the text and, in a sense, offer up these segments of text while regarding myself with the necessary critical distance. I'm not an expert in this field, and I consider myself a student of this line of inquiry. And in a sense, what I'm doing with you, the listeners, is inviting you to walk along the path with me in order to help determine exactly how far some of this technology could be developed. And I'm not sure exactly what year this was. This was early on. This was pre-World War II. In fact, I think this was pre-World War I. In Mulberry Street, in what was called Little Italy in New York City, Tesla was doing some experiments in mechanical oscillation. This was well before the Second World War. And talking about the local police who were familiar with Nikola Tesla's experiments and were not real crazy about him. On this particular morning, the cops were surprised to feel the building rumbling under their feet. Chairs moved across floors with no one near them. Objects on the officers' desks danced about and the desks themselves moved. It must be an earthquake. It grew stronger. Chunks of plaster fell from the ceilings. A flood of water ran down one of the stairs from a broken pipe. The windows started to vibrate with a shrill note that grew more intense. Some of the windows shattered. "That isn't an earthquake," shouted one of the officers. "It's that blankety-blank Tesla. Get up there quickly," unquote. He called to a squad of men and stop him. Use force if you have to, but stop him. He'll wreck the city. The officers started on a run for the building around the corner. Pouring into the streets were many scores of people excitedly leaving nearby tenement and factory buildings, believing an earthquake had caused the smashing of windows, breaking of pipes, moving of furniture, and strange vibrations. Without waiting for the slow-pokey elevator, the cops rushed up the stairs, and as they did so, they felt the building vibrate even more strongly than did police headquarters. There was a sense of impending doom that the whole building would disintegrate, and their fears were not relieved by the sound of smashing glass and the queer roars and screams that came from the walls and floors. Could they reach Tesla's laboratory in time to stop him? Or would the building tumble down on their heads and everyone in it be buried in the ruins, and probably every building in the neighborhood? Maybe he was making the whole earth shake in this way. Would this madman be destroying the world? It was destroyed once before by water. Maybe this time it would be destroyed by that agent of the devil that they call electricity. Just as the cops rushed into Tesla's laboratory to tackle they knew not what, the vibrations stopped and they beheld a strange sight. They arrived just in time to see the tall, gaunt figure of the inventor swinging a heavy sledgehammer and shatter a small iron contraption mounted on the post in the middle of the room. Pandemonium gave way to a deep, heavy silence. Tesla was the first to break the silence. Resting his sledgehammer against the pillar, he turned his tall, lean, coatless figure to the cops. He was always self-possessed, always a commanding presence, an effect that could in no way be attributed to his slender build, but seemed more to emanate from his eyes. Bowing from the waist in his courtly manner, he addressed the policemen, who were too out of breath to speak, and probably overawed into silence by their fantastic experience. "Gentlemen," he said, "I am sorry, but you are just a trifle too late to witness my experiment. Unexpectedly, in an unusual way, just as you entered. If you will come around this evening, I will have another oscillator attached to this platform, and each of you can stand on it. You will, I am sure, find it a most interesting and pleasurable experience. Now you must leave, for I have many things to do. Good day, gentlemen." Unquote. George Shirk, Tesla's secretary, was standing nearby when Tesla so dramatically smashed his earthquake maker. Tesla never told the story beyond this point, and Mr. Shirk declares he does not recall what the response of the cops was. Imagination must furnish the finale to this story. At the moment, though, Tesla was quite sincere in his attitude. He had no idea of what had happened elsewhere in his neighborhood as a result of his experiment, but the effect on his own laboratory had been sufficiently threatening to cause him to halt it suddenly. When he learned the details, however, he was convinced that he was correct in his belief that the field of mechanical vibrations was rich with opportunities for scientific investigation. We have no records available of any further major experiments with vibration in that laboratory. Perhaps the police and building departments had offered some emphatic suggestions to him concerning experiments of this nature. Tesla's observations in this experiment were limited to what took place on the floor of the building in which his laboratory was located, but apparently very little happened there until a great deal had happened elsewhere. The oscillator was firmly fixed to a supporting column, and there were similar supporting columns directly under it on each floor down to the foundations. The vibrations were transmitted through the columns to the ground. This section of the city is built on deep sand that extends down some hundreds of feet before bedrock is reached. It is well known to seismologists that earthquake vibrations are transmitted by sand with much greater intensity than they are by rock. The ground under the building and around it was therefore an excellent transmitter of mechanical vibrations, which spread out in all directions. They may have reached a mile or more. They were more intense, of course, near their source and became weaker as the distance increased. However, even weak vibrations that are sustained can build up surprisingly large effects when they are absorbed by an object with which they are in resonance. A distant object in resonance can be thrown into strong vibration, whereas a much nearer object not in resonance will be left unaffected. It was this selective resonance that was apparently operating in Tesla's experiment. Buildings other than his own came into resonance with the increasing tempo of his oscillator long before his own building was affected. After the pandemonium was underway for some time elsewhere and the higher frequencies were reached, his immediate surroundings started to come into resonance. When resonance is reached, the effects follow instantly and powerfully. Tesla knew this, so when he observed dangerous resonance effects developing in his building, he realized he had to act fast. The oscillator was being operated by compressed air supplied by a motor-driven compressor that fed the air into a tank where it was stored under pressure. Even if the motor were shut off, there was plenty of air in the tank to keep the oscillator going for many minutes, and in that time, the building could be completely wrecked and reduced to a pile of debris. With the vibrations reaching this dangerous amplitude, There was no time to try to disconnect the vibrator from the airline or to do anything about releasing the air from the tank. There was time for only one thing, and Tesla did that. He grabbed the nearby sledgehammer and took a mighty swing at the oscillator in hopes of putting it out of operation. He succeeded on his first attempt. That's one of the things to consider in terms of the technology of Nikola Tesla. And this, by the way, is quite well documented, that this actually happened. And there's nothing particularly fancy about it. It uses basically the principles of mechanical resonance. Music, one of the other applications of some of those same principles. What I do not understand at all, and by the way, here Nikola Tesla was producing an earthquake, and this was in the early part of the 20th century. What I wonder can be done now with the kinds of technologies that we have, and in particular applying some of our contemporary technology to some of the fields of inquiry that Tesla was engaged in. Now again, I don't know what precisely can be done, but I think the implications are really, really frightening. Something else that Nikola Tesla investigated, and I think this also needs to be looked into, that is electrical resonance. Now this is not something I understand particularly well. I think, however, in the background of the HARP project, which we're going to get to in a minute, this is something that needs to be seriously considered. And I'm presenting this Tesla material in an interrogatory mode. This is not something I understand past the point. People who are relatively expert in this field tell me that this is basically on the frontier of R&D with regard to the science and warfare of the 21st century. And I think my instinct told me that Project HARP might be connected with some aspects of Tesla technology, and indeed I understand now that some of the patents do indeed draw on Tesla patent technology. Tesla was also examining electrical resonance, and I'm going to describe some of the, I'm going to read a section of this, again from the book Prodigal Genius. In describing his work with a giant oscillator, now this is electrical oscillation, Tesla, using his conservative estimates of his results, stated in his article in the Century magazine of June 1900, quote, however extraordinary the results shown may appear, they are but trifling compared with those attainable by apparatus designed on these same principles. I have produced electrical discharges, the actual path of which from end to end was probably more than 100 feet long, but it would not be difficult to reach lengths as 100 times as great. I have produced electrical movements occurring at the rate of approximately 100,000 horsepower, but rates of 1, 5, or 10 million horsepower are easily practicable. In these experiments, effects were developed incomparably greater than ever produced by any human agencies, and yet these results are but an embryo of what is to be. The method used by Tesla to set the Earth in electrical oscillation is the electrical counterpart of the mechanical device previously described. That's the earthquake, just a simple mechanical oscillator. The plunger bobbing up and down at the right rhythm that created the stationary waves in the water. Tesla used a stream of electrons which were pumped into and drawn out of the earth at a rapid rhythmic rate. At the time the experiments were made, the electron still was not known to be the fundamental atom of electricity, so the operation was spoken of simply as the flow of electricity. The pumping operation was carried on at a rate of 150,000 oscillations per second. These would produce electrical pulsations with a wavelength of 2,000 meters, about 6,600 feet. When the moving waves expanded outward from Colorado Springs, they traveled in all directions in ever-increasing circles until they passed over the bulge of the Earth, and then in ever smaller circles and with increasing intensity converged on the diametrically opposite point of the Earth, a trifle to the west of the two French islands Amsterdam and St. Paul, in the area between the Indian and Antarctic Oceans, midway between the southern tip of Africa and the southwest corner of Australia. Here, a tremendous electrical south pole was built up, marked by a wave of great amplitude that rose and fell in unison with Tesla's apparatus at its north pole in Colorado Springs. As this wave fell, it sent back an electrical echo which produced the same effect at Colorado Springs. Just as it arrived back at Colorado Springs, the oscillator was working to build up a wave that would reinforce it and send it back more powerfully than before to the antipode to repeat the performance. If there were no losses in this operation, if the Earth were a perfect electrical conductor, and there were no other sources of resonance, this resonance phenomena would build up to a destructive action of gigantic proportions, even with the charging source only about 300 horsepower, which Tesla used. Voltages of gigantic magnitudes would be built up. Charged particles of matter would be hurled outward from the Earth with vast energies, and eventually even the solid matter of the Earth would be affected, and the whole planet disintegrated. Pure resonance, however, is not attainable. Tesla frequently stressed the fortunate nature of this fact, for otherwise disastrous results could be produced by small amounts of energy. Now, looking ahead to Project HARP, what could be produced with large amounts of energy, and that indeed it appears that that project is aiming to do that. And again, this is not something I'm in a position to answer, but rather I think it's a question that those who are qualified to answer must answer if we are to survive the world to come in one piece. Continuing. The electrical resistance of the globe would prevent the attainment of pure resonance, but practical resonance can be attained with safety by supplying continuously the amount of energy lost in resistance, and this supplies perfect control of the situation. With the Earth set in electrical oscillation, a source of energy is provided at all spots on the Earth. This could be drawn off and made available for use by a simple apparatus which would contain the same elements as the tuning unit in a radio set, but larger, a coil and a condenser, a ground connection, and metal rod high as a cottage. Such a combination would absorb at any point on the Earth's surface energy from the waves rushing back and forth between the electrical north and south poles created by the Tesla oscillators. No other equipment would be needed to supply light to the home provided with Tesla's simple vacuum tube lamps or to produce heating effects. Again, something else that I think needs to be contemplated, and this, again, is in interrogatory mode in connection with Tesla technology. And again, this work was being done in the early part of this century. I wonder what has been done behind the scenes in the intervening years. One of the things that Tesla supposedly had worked out the principles for was something that has been misrepresented as a death ray. It was actually more like a charged shield, which could be used as an awesome weapon during time of war. This is described, and again, what this might be, I don't know, and I want to stress that. I think that we need to seriously examine this, in particular as we examine what looms in the background, possibly, of Project HARP. The announcement by Tesla in his latter years that attracted the greatest amount of attention concerned his discovery of what has briefly, but not too accurately, been termed a death ray. Earlier reports had come from Europe of the invention of death rays, beams of radiation that would cause airships on which they impinged to burst into flame, the steel bodies of tanks to melt, and the machinery of ships to stop operating, but all gave indications of being part of the game of diplomatic bunkum. The prelude to Tesla's death ray announcement came several years in advance in the form of a declaration that he had made discoveries concerning a new form of power generation which, when applied, would make the largest existing turbine dynamo units in the powerhouses look like pygmies. He made this announcement in interviews with the press in 1933 and declared that he was also working on a new kind of generator for the production of radiation of all kinds and in the greatest intensities. He made similar announcements the following year, skipping down. When Tesla was talking as a scientist, he was opposed to wars on moral, economic, and all practical and theoretical grounds. But, like most scientists, when he stopped thinking as a scientist and let his emotions rule his thoughts, he found exceptions in which he felt some wars and situations were justifiable. As a scientist, he was unwilling to have the discoveries of scientists applied to the purposes of war makers. But when the emotional phase of his nature took the ruling position, he was willing to apply his genius to devising measures that would prevent wars by supplying protective devices. And again, consider Project HARP in connection with some of these ruminations here.
Okay, Tim?
This attitude is exemplified in the following statement, which he had prepared in the 20s but did not publish. Quote, "At present, many of the ablest minds are trying to devise expedients for preventing a repetition of the awful conflict which has only theoretically ended, and the duration and main issues of which I correctly predicted in an article printed in The Sun of December 20th, 1914. This is, of course, World War I. The League of Nations, is not a remedy, but on the contrary, in the opinion of a number of competent men, may bring about results just the opposite. It is particularly regrettable that a punitive policy was adopted in framing the terms of peace, because a few years hence it will be possible for nations to fight without armies, ships, or guns by weapons far more terrible to the destructive action and range of which there is virtually no limit. Any city at any distance whatsoever from the enemy can be destroyed by him, and no power on earth can stop him from doing so. If we want to avert an impending calamity and a state of things which may transform this globe into an inferno, We should push the development of flying machines and wireless transmission of energy without an instant's delay and with all the power and resources of the nation." Unquote. Tesla saw preventative possibilities in his new invention, which embodied, quote, death ray, unquote, characteristics, and which was made several years after the foregoing statement was written. He saw it providing a curtain of protection which any country, no matter how small, could use as a defense against invasion. While he might offer it as a defensive weapon, however, there would be nothing to stop military men from using it as a weapon of offense. Tesla never gave the slightest hint concerning the principles under which his device operated. And one of the very last passages in the book, after Tesla's death, the police were notified that this, by the way, he died on January 7th, 1943, right in the middle of World War II. The police were notified that Tesla had died alone and without medical attendance. The coroner declared his death due to natural causes incident to senility, and that he had died on the night of Thursday, January 7th, 1943, some hours before the maid entered the room. Operatives from the Federal Bureau of Investigation came and opened the safe in his room and took the papers it contained to examine them for a reported important secret invention of possible use in the war. The body was removed to Campbell's funeral parlors at Madison Avenue and 81st Street. Again, one wonders, and again, I'm not stating this in a declarative fashion, one wonders how far the research of Nikola Tesla has been carried in the more than half century since his death, given the advances in electronics and technology in general. Now, let's jump ahead to 1978, specifically. I'm going to read a short section from a document called Documents on Disarmament, 1978. It's published by the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. This is United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency Publication 107, released October of 1980. This is published by the Superintendent of Documents, U.S. Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C., 20402. These are some excerpts from a letter from then-Secretary of State Cyrus Vance to then-President Jimmy Carter from August 31st, 1978, concerning the treaty between the U.S. and Soviet Union on the uses of environmental modification techniques for the purposes of war. Now, bear in mind, this is 17 years ago, and this was when the treaty was concluded. It was under serious negotiation by the early 1970s, and it was more than 20 years ago. Just think what the reaction would have been on the part of the average citizen in, say, 1925 if you would discuss the possibility of an atomic bomb. Think of how fantastic that would have seemed, and yet we are at the same distance of time from this treaty as that person would have been from the first known use of the atomic bomb in 1945. Bear in mind, too, that as a rule of thumb, if the U.S. and former Soviet Union were engaged in serious negotiations by the early 70s, culminating in a treaty that was signed by 77, that means that the types of things that I'm going to discuss were already viewed as either being possible then or in an imminent state of research and development, so that these were being looked at as possibilities in the not-too-distant future. And again, I'm going to liberally skip ahead here in the interest of time. Secretary of State Vance wrote to Jimmy Carter, "This convention, signed on behalf of the United States on May 18, 1977, is the product of a number of initiatives, the first of which was taken more than 5 years ago. In July of 1972, the Subcommittee on Oceans and International Environment of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations conducted hearings on Senate Resolution 281, expressing the sense of the Senate that the United States should seek the agreement of other governments to a treaty prohibiting the use of environmental or geophysical modification activity as a weapon of war. On February 22, 1973, Senate Resolution 281 was reintroduced as Senate Resolution 71, which was passed on July 11, 1973 by a vote of 82-10. In early 1974, more than 20 years ago, at the request of the President, the Department of Defense carried out a review of the military aspects of weather modification and other environmental modification techniques. This review was followed by an interagency study of possible international restraints on these techniques. Later that year, at the Moscow Summit meeting on July 3, 1974, the United States and the Soviet Union issued a joint statement pledging to hold discussions to consider the dangers of environmental warfare and possible measures to overcome such dangers. The sessions were held in late 1974 and 1975, which resulted in agreed language for a multilateral convention. On August 21, 1975, the United States and the Soviet Union tabled identical draft texts of a convention at the Conference of the Committee on Disarmament in Geneva. And skipping down again, the third perambular paragraph, this is of the treaty itself. Now listen to some of the things that they were talking about doing. Listen to some of the actual text of this agreement. And again, 20 years ago they were working on this. The third perambular paragraph recognizes the fact that scientific and technical advances may open up new possibilities for modifying the environment. The fourth perambular paragraph, through a lot of diplomatic language. Here we go, getting down to the actual excerpt. You could tell these people were diplomats. They take about 10 times as long to say anything as they might have. Article 2 defines the term, quote, environmental modification techniques, unquote, as, quote, any technique for changing through the deliberate manipulation of natural processes the dynamics, composition, or structure of the Earth, including its biota, lithosphere, hydrosphere, and atmosphere, or of outer space, unquote. The understanding related to this article sets forth the following examples as illustrative of the phenomena that could be caused by the use of such techniques. And here are some of the phenomena that they were envisioning as being able to produce. Earthquakes, tsunamis, an upset in the ecological balance of a region, changes in weather patterns, clouds, precipitation, cyclones of various types, and tornadic storms, changes in climate patterns, changes in ocean currents, changes in the state of the ozone layer, and changes in the state of the ionosphere, unquote. Quoting from this treaty, damn bloody near 20 years old. Now, going to jump ahead to one of the titular elements of the lecture this evening, Project HARP, which stands for High Altitude Auroral, High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, H-A-A-R-P for short. This is from an article, the cover story actually, of Popular Science magazine from September of this year. This is an article called Mystery in Alaska by Mark Farmer. And we read of the Project HARP, which basically is using extremely low frequency, or ELF, electromagnetic radiation, to heat up portions of the ionosphere in order to do a number of different things. Now, there are a number of things that it states that it can do. What I wonder is what we are not being told, some of the other applications of this technology. Some of the things that this technology can do, and again, this is a multi-million dollar project currently underway, highly secretive in Alaska. Aha! I can see you on edge in the project, cop! What is that device going to do now? All kidding aside, because this is not funny. It may be a joke, but it's not funny. Some of the possible effects of this mystery in Alaska, or Project HARP. Injecting high-frequency radio energy into the ionosphere. Now, just ruminate a little bit on how Tesla technology might figure in the background of some of this. And again, I want to stress very strongly, the reason why I'm being as pedantic as I'm being here is because I don't know past a point what some of this could do. But it scares the living bloody hell out of me. And I am afraid that we are not in Kansas anymore, Toto, and that indeed we may find ourselves in awfully, awfully serious trouble. Injecting high-frequency radio energy into the ionosphere. Now remember, tampering with the ionosphere was forbidden by the language of that treaty. That was one of the things that they could do and that was forbidden. Injecting high-frequency radio energy into the ionosphere to create huge, extremely low-frequency, or ELF, virtual antennas used for Earth-penetrating tomography, peering deep beneath the surface of the ground by collecting and analyzing reflected ELF waves beamed down from above. Now, the stated technology of this is to look for underground installations, like bunkers deep under the earth, which it might be. I also wonder to what extent one could determine whether there are layers of sand underneath the earth that might be an ideal conductor for earthquake waves, or something like what Nikola Tesla was doing in New York. Again, this is rumination. Continuing. In the immediate post-World War II period, Major Robert Staver was talking about how they wanted to orbit reflectors around the Earth to reflect the sun's rays and for A, power-generating purposes, but also as a devastating weapon of mass destruction that would permit the first nation to build it to rule the world. Among the other possible applications of the HARP technology, heating regions of the lower and upper atmosphere to form virtual, quote, lenses, unquote, and, quote, mirrors, unquote, that can reflect a broad range of radio frequencies far over the horizon to detect stealthy cruise missiles and aircraft. And again, I wonder what else. And basically, we're talking about heating up the ionosphere to create reflecting surfaces to reflect electromagnetic radiation. This would permit the distinguishing between decoy warheads and actual warheads in the event of a nuclear salvo. I wonder if perhaps other things might be possible as well. Other applications: generating ELF radio waves in the ionosphere to communicate across large distances with deeply submerged submarines. And patent documents filed during an earlier research effort that evolved into the HARP program outline further military applications of ionospheric heating technology. Creating, and remember the Tesla concept of a shield, a defensive shield, not actually a death ray, but something that could be turned into an offensive application. Creating a full global shield that would destroy ballistic missiles by overheating their electronic guidance systems as they fly through a powerful radio energy field. Distinguishing nuclear warheads from decoys by sensing their elemental composition. And, listen to this one, the last application, manipulating local weather, something actually forbidden by the treaty between the U.S. and former USSR. Skipping down again. The IRI here is the ionospheric research instrument that is a further development of HARP. Virtual lenses and mirrors will be generated in the ionosphere if the IRI works as intended. Now, instead of actual reflectors to reflect the sun's rays onto the Earth, they're talking about heated areas of the ionosphere to reflect electromagnetic radiation on the Earth for a variety of stated purposes. I wonder whether perhaps there are some not stated purposes as well. Virtual lenses and mirrors will be generated in the ionosphere if the IRI works as intended. By precisely warming a patch of the lower ionosphere, the IRI reduces its density relative to the surrounding atmosphere. An ionospheric lens thus formed can in turn focus a radio beam into the upper atmosphere. Normally, most high-frequency radio waves broadcast from the ground are absorbed or scattered in the lower ionosphere, and few of them reach such high altitudes. Next, the focused radio beam excites a patch of the upper ionosphere to form a virtual mirror. Finally, a radio communication signal broadcast by the IRI, focused through the lens and reflected from the mirror, can be directed far over the horizon. In other words, in principle, not really all that different from what the Nazi scientists had envisioned, except instead of an actual mechanical reflector for the sun's rays, it's a virtual reflector for ELF radiation, radio waves. Virtual lenses and mirrors could also be used to scan a blanket of very low frequency or VLF radio waves transmitted by an over-the-horizon radar. Although they reflect little VLF energy, stealth aircraft can appear from above as holes in the blanket, thus betraying their position. Proprietary phased array transmitting, steering, and pulsing techniques built into the IRI will permit rapid aiming of the radio frequency beam in any direction and at angles as low as 30 degrees above the horizon. This oblique heating ability enables HARP to form virtual lenses or mirrors at distances of more than 1,000 miles from the transmitter. And remember these radio waves, because we're going to talk about some of the possible side effects of some of these radio waves, or perhaps what they could be used for offensive purposes. Skipping down again. The full global shield is an exotic proposal for an Earth-encompassing shell of high-speed electrons and ions that will be generated by a much more powerful version of HARP. Any missile or warhead passing through the protective shell would explode. Or a soft-kill weapon system using ELF waves produced by HARP heating could be used to overload power distribution grids and destroy unshielded microelectronics using electromagnetic pulse energy, similar to that released by a high-altitude nuclear explosion. Just think about the death ray that Tesla had supposedly developed by the 1920s. And think about the possible applications of HARP technology. And again, this is an interrogatory, not declarative mode. Skipping down again. Now, bear in mind the treaty between the former U.S. and USSR. Weather manipulation may be possible by building an ionospheric heater 1,000-fold more powerful than HARP. Differential heating of areas of the atmosphere could induce local weather conditions such as floods or droughts useful to the military. Smooth seas might suddenly be raked by treacherous squalls, creating or denying a technical advantage. Basically, weather warfare, something that's forbidden by the treaty. We're basically breaking a treaty, although, you know, the former USSR doesn't exist and Russia's awfully weak. And we're going to skip down again, and we're going to bear in mind my recounting of the circumstances surrounding the investigation into Port Chicago, with which we began this. That's why I talk about from Port Chicago to Project HARP. That's why I've entitled this lecture that. Bear in mind also when Peter Vogel took his Port Chicago document, or his history of the 10,000-ton gadget, and showed it to his former professor, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, a person who had been centrally positioned and had obviously known about the Port Chicago research. And Edward Teller said, basically, I will refuse to acknowledge that I ever saw these documents. I will deny ever having spoken to you about Port Chicago. These are classified documents. Get them back to the laboratory. Remember old Edward Teller. Skipping down again in the Popular Mechanics article. One of the most grandiose systems described in his patents, he, by the way, is Bernard Eastland, E-A-S-T-L-U-N-D, in many ways the father of HARP, which originally was a brainchild of ARCO. They were going to use tremendous amounts of natural gas from the Alaskan natural gas fields to generate the enormous amounts of power to be used in the system. One of the most grandiose systems described in his patents is a 40-mile square HARP-like radio transmitter that would have used huge amounts of electrical power generated by turbines burning natural gas drawn from the vast North Slope reserves, again, Alaska. Returning again to the text, quote, full global shield, unquote. Again, think about Tesla. Was conceived to wipe out the guidance systems of missiles in flight anywhere in the world, and I wonder perhaps what else. Quote, I founded and led the ARCO program until 1987, unquote, Eastland says. Again, quoting, about that time, Edward Teller visited Robert Hirsch, the ARCO vice president who had hired me. I don't know the direct results of that discussion, but shortly thereafter, new secret initiatives began which I was not privy to, and I declined further involvement, unquote. Teller is a co-designer of the hydrogen bomb and was the arch proponent of the now-abandoned X-ray laser, the centerpiece of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars missile defense program. Asked about his involvement in the beginnings of HARP, Teller responded, quote, I have no idea about that. I don't remember anything about it, unquote. Well, just remember what he told Peter Vogel about his showing him the Port Chicago document. See, same son of a bitch is involved with this as was involved all the way back with Port Chicago. Continuing. Although it is much smaller than a full global shield system, Eastland says, quote, HARP is the perfect first step toward a plan like mine. Advances in phased array transmitter technology and power generation can produce the field strength required. The government will say it isn't so, but if it quacks like a duck, and it looks like a duck, there's a good chance that it is a duck. And skipping down again, talking about some of the deleterious environmental side effects, and even, by the way, this is a joint Air Force and Navy project, and even the Air Force and Navy acknowledge the following. Eastland himself observes that, quote, there has never been a transmitter of this power in this frequency band. It would be wise to assess its impact, unquote. The 440-page HARP environmental impact statements filed by the Air Force says that the normally upward-directed IRI transmissions can raise the internal body temperature of nearby people. These are nearby people. These are normally upward. Suppose you were to focus these transmissions on people directly. If it's going to raise the internal body temperature of people near it, what might it do if you focus them directly on the people? Well, we have a hint here. Beginning again, the 440-page HARP environmental impact statement filed by the Air Force says that the normally upward-directed IRI transmissions can raise the internal body temperature of nearby people, ignite road flares in the trunks of cars, detonate aerial munitions that use electronic fuses, and scramble aircraft communications, navigation, and flight control systems. Just suppose for the sake of argument, and again, I want to stress I am not technically qualified to say for sure what the potentials of a system like this might be. I also wonder about possible mind control applications, about disrupting brain waves for certain population groups. But if this is what these normally upward-directed things can do to people nearby, suppose these virtual lenses and mirrors were used to focus these things deliberately on people. Might it be, and I think in certain respects it is, essentially the same concept as the Nazi rocket scientists' concept of reflectors orbiting the Earth to focus the sun's rays on people, except these are virtual lenses and mirrors made by heating the ionosphere and directing radio waves on people. But raising the internal body temperature of people nearby, igniting road flares in the trunks of cars, this by being near the beams, what might happen if you focus? Could this be the death ray of Nikola Tesla? I think this warrants serious consideration and serious investigation. And again, I'm not qualified to make an objective statement in that regard. But consider Tesla's experiments into electrical oscillation as well as mechanical oscillation and the deep earth tomography and weather manipulation by its own standards. Just what is possible here? Again, I think that, and I do not know past the point what the HARP project holds as possibilities. It is axiomatic with regard to military research and development that whatever the real possibility, since this is a highly secretive project, we're not going to be told past the point. But I wonder, and I don't think that I'm off base by seeing this as potentially, again, the final evolutionary stage of what the Nazi rocket scientists saw. Again, instead of actual mirrors orbiting the Earth to reflect the sun's rays and form a death ray out of heat out of the sun's rays, these are virtual lenses and mirrors for all kinds of things. Weather manipulation, who knows what they could use the deep earth tomography for, perhaps just identifying sand and things that could be utilized for seismic weaponry. Again, the focus of a treaty by the U.S. and former USSR more than 20 years ago. Think about some of the side effects of people on whom the beams aren't even focused. What might happen if you use those virtual lenses and mirrors to focus these things on human beings? It might boil them alive. And it was something very much along the lines of what the rocket scientists envisioned all the way back in 1945 when Robert Staver wanted to bring these sons of bitches into the United States in the first place. And I think we need to very seriously contemplate where we are going. Because history teaches us, it's even ironic that we find, and I think significant, that we find Edward Teller looming very large in the background of Project HARP as well. He was in the background of Port Chicago, you know, an element of continuity from the past to the present. Again, I want to stress that the reason why this has been so pedantic and why I feel compelled to refer to the text, again, I do not have the technical, critical expertise to make a definitive evaluation of this literature past the point, but rather, what I am doing is basically inviting you to walk this path along with me, because I think there are some very scary things that are going to be seen on this journey, and I think we all need to take a good, hard, objective look at what we're seeing there and avoid deceiving ourselves. And I think people with the requisite technical qualifications it is absolutely mandatory on those people to take a look at what the hell we're doing, whether it's in UFOs or the HARP technology, seismic weather manipulations, God knows what. Because again, as Einstein noted with regard to the development of the atomic bomb, the first one of which was used on us without our knowledge at Port Chicago, everything has changed but our way of thinking. Certainly earthquakes happen. There are all kinds of extremes of weather. There have been many extreme weather patterns in the past, and we're altering the environment. But how much of the extreme weather we're seeing, some of the extraordinary heat waves, and there are tremendous variations in weather patterns, how much of this might be due to clandestine experimentation? Again, one does not want to be Chicken Little and say, oh my God, they had 5 days of 100-plus temperatures in so-and-so. That must mean Project HARP has been turned on. Not necessarily, but I would not necessarily rule out the possibility that just as the Mark II was used clandestinely on unsuspecting citizens, so too Project HARP, the ultimate brainchild, the ultimate development of people, playmates like Edward Teller, might also either be used or perhaps already be being used. The last substantive item in the lecture this evening, and this is perhaps only slightly in a lighter note, what I'm about to read you might have no significance whatsoever. On the other hand, it might have some significance. Jumping back again, I love the relationship between the past and the present. Rereading just for a second the Nazi rocket scientists' plans as relayed by Robert Staver in May of 1945, just after the end of the war in Europe. They would construct a large reflector for focusing the sun's rays onto the earth for power generating purposes. The latter could be used as well for another objective, quote, which has been described as a terrible thing, a weapon which will enable the first country to achieve this undertaking to rule the world. The focusing of this reflector upon any living persons would kill them immediately. Ocean water would be instantly turned to steam, a forest instantly kindled, unquote. I'm going to skip ahead 50 years to 1995, specifically the San Francisco Chronicle from Tuesday, March 21st of 1995. In the personal section, it's a little column by a woman named Leah Garchick. She's talking about some of the little ideas and foibles of Newt Gingrich, of course, now the Speaker of the House of Representatives. And she goes on to say, in his 1984 book, Window of Opportunity, unquote, Gingrich imagined the fruits of space exploration. A, quote, mirror system in space could provide the light equivalent of many full moons so that there would be no need for nighttime lighting of the highways, unquote. Well, hold down now. What do you suppose this old Georgia boy got himself a little idea like that? Put some mirrors out in space and reflect the sun's light onto the Earth like that? That's exactly what the Nazi rocket scientist had in mind. I wonder. You know, I suspect that Gingrich might actually represent a Nazi fifth column inside of this country. It could just be coincidence. Maybe this is just Newt running his. Maybe this belongs in the same category of intellectual endeavor as his ideas about Boys Town, you know, that 1938 movie which should act as a model for our social legislation. But Gingrich is a very interesting fellow. He attended an American military high school in Kaiserslautern in Germany in a time period in which a major focus of German Nazis was recruiting American servicemen and their dependents to the Nazi cause. And in fact, very significant elements such as the conservative USA group of Larry Schmidt and the efforts of Charles Willoughby, nay Karl Adolf von Zeppelin Wiedenbach, MacArthur's top intelligence officer, and in all probability a principal in the assassination of President Kennedy, a German Nazi, was very active in the late 50s and early 60s in recruiting American military service people and their dependents to the Nazi cause. This was a major focus of extreme American right wing and German Nazi efforts in this time period, and it was in this time period that Newt Gingrich was going to high school in Kaiserslautern. He was a service brat, basically. And I notice he has this novel out called 1945. Very interesting novel. It's about Germany winning World War II in Europe, conquering the Soviet Union and Britain, and then facing off against the United States, which had vanquished Japan. And it involves a Nazi commando raid led by Otto Skorzeny, in which Nazi commandos execute all of the American nuclear scientists who were going to build the atomic bomb. I guess a hero comes along and saves the U.S. But it's a pretty interesting little novel for the Speaker of the United States to be writing, basically envisioning a Nazi victory in World War II. Very, very interesting. Also, there's a novel, quote novel, unquote, put out by National Vanguard. That's a Nazi publisher. It, I think, is more than just a novel. It's a terrifying and very depressing book. I think it's more than a novel. I think it's actually a blueprint for what they're planning on doing. It's called Serpent's Walk. And it's about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the middle of the 21st century in which several generations of SS personnel on down the line. It assumes that the SS go underground, perpetrate succeeding generations, begin building their economic muscle, infiltrate the army, use their economic clout to buy into the American opinion-forming media, and then basically propagandize the American people in a Nazi fashion. And then these Nazi personnel who infiltrate the army take over the United States, and it becomes a Nazi country. One of the key events is there's a chemical and biological exchange between Russia and the United States in which the president and vice president are killed, and the Speaker of the House becomes president of the United States. That's one of the central elements in this Nazi takeover. I would note that we've just had in Oklahoma City, you've just had basically a bunch of Nazis, hockey pucks, but the three people charged were all members of the same military unit. Also, you have Ruby Ridge. Now you have a white supremacist, Randy Weaver, being made into a national martyr, kind of like Horace Vessel. The guy who basically helped break that siege was his former commanding officer in the Green Beret, Bo Greitz, who has some very, you know, but Roy may view Bo Greitz as a swell fella. Bo Greitz has some very interesting connections. All of which doesn't prove anything necessarily about George Boy Newt Gingrich. But I just find it more than a little interesting that this fellow who likes to write novels about a Nazi victory in World War II and who was being educated in Germany at a time when it was a major focus of recruiting American service dependents to the Nazi cause, that his idea of a great way to conserve energy would be to set a bunch of mirrors up in space in order to reflect the sun's light on the Earth. Coincidentally or not, just exactly what the Nazi rocket scientists had in mind in 1945. And something which I suspect in its basic parameters, albeit the actual instrumentalities are different, may very well anticipate Project Harp. It said, there's a book out now I have not obtained, says, Angels Don't Play This Harp. Well, if this harp turns out to be what I'm afraid it might be, it's going to make angels out of a lot of us. And we may be playing our harps as a result. of this harp. And I think we need to take a cold, long look at just what the hell is going on the frontier of military research and development, because again, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto, and we need to pay a great deal of attention to the man behind the curtain, whether it's, oh, Georgia boy, Newt Gingrich, you know, mirror, mirror out in space. Must you reflect Newt Gingrich's face? I hope not. Not my favorite face, all in all. Anyway, that concludes the balance, includes the formal part of the lecture for this evening. I want to thank you for your attention and patience, as always, for putting up what is a carrot has been even more pedantic than my usual presentation, which is pretty damn pedantic.